The LexisNexis Real Estate Law Community Podcast. Presentations and interviews with leading attorneys and industry professionals. On this edition, Stephen J. Wernick of Bilson, Sumberg, Baina, Price & Axelrod, LLP, on Smart Growth. The opinions expressed by guests interviewed on LexisNexis Legal Podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of Reed Elsevier Incorporated, LexisNexis, subsidiary companies, shareholders, employees, or customers, and should not be considered legal advice. Stephen J. Wernick is an associate in Bilson Sumberg's Land Use and Government Relations Group in Miami, Florida. Steve represents clients in all aspects of the development approval process, including planning and zoning applications, developments of regional impact, development agreements, and complex environmental and land use permitting. Steve assists clients in navigating the intricacies of government affairs, including representation of client interests in administrative and quasi-judicial hearings, code enforcement hearings, and negotiation of public and private incentive agreements. Steve's also got experience in the public sector, drafting zoning ordinances and land use development regulations. Steve's been invited to speak on topics of land use and local government law and has been cited in numerous secondary sources, including Powell on Real Property and Land Use, Planning, and the Environment, a casebook. He is the author of the new chapter in Powell on Real Property on Smart Growth. Steve, how are you? Thanks for being with us on this podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Smart growth. Now, my understanding is if you like to walk instead of drive, you might like living in an area developed using the principles of smart growth. So, as an initial question, what is smart growth?
Well, smart growth is really the latest wave in the growth management movement, which really started in the 1960s and 70s with some of the initial environmental resource protection legislation, both on the state and federal level, also land use regulation that many states enacted in the 60s and 70s. So probably around the late 1980s, early 1990s, a group of architects and planners and other folks interested in urban redevelopment got together and formed the Congress for New Urbanism. And the neo-traditional development movement, the new urbanist movement, there are many names for a variety of activities and policies that were being promoted that really spoke to a desire to get back to traditional neighborhood development where folks would walk more often and communities could be developed in a way where shop owners were located down the street from residents and offices may be above the shops or apartments are above the shops. And so in the early 1990s, with some of the older cities in the Northeast and the Midwest going through a redevelopment of their downtown cores, the smart growth movement really came about and became popular. And it was a response to suburban sprawl in many ways, a return to the cities. And it's an attempt to create sustainable pedestrian-friendly communities. And I'll read you the definition that the American Planning Association has devised, which says smart growth means using comprehensive planning to guide, design, develop, revitalize, and build communities for all that have a unique sense of community and place, that preserve and enhance valuable natural and cultural resources, that equitably distribute the costs and benefits of development, that expand the range of transportation, employment, and housing choices in a fiscally responsible manner, that value long-range regional considerations or sustainability over short-term, incremental, geographically isolated actions, and promote public health and healthy communities. So smart growth is really aiming at what some refer to as sustainability or sustainable development, and that's what smart growth is.
And I hate to use the phrase, but it sounds like it's got characteristics of small-town USA.
That's right, and if you've seen the movie The Truman Show, that features Seaside, which is a town in Florida's Panhandle, which was one of the first new urbanist communities that was developed by Duane Plater Zyberg, which is one of the founding firms that was part of the Congress for New Urbanism.
But it's not just a developer's vision now, is it? I understand there is significant government action now to promote and even require smart growth planning in many areas. What kinds of requirements are you seeing now around the country?
Well, we're starting to see requirements on the state level as well as the local government level. And let me talk about the state level first. There are what I've identified as four different approaches that states are taking. The first being the comprehensive statewide approach, where states like Maryland and Iowa have adopted uniform goals in their statewide comprehensive plan. And they are addressing the actions of local governments and requiring that those local governments comply with these uniform goals on a statewide basis. They're also tying spending to compliance by local governments with these goals. For example, Maryland has adopted a statewide land use goal to increase the percentage of growth within priority funding areas. And these priority funding areas, as the name suggests, encourage local governments to develop or have their developers build within priority funding areas in order that they can continue receiving the funds for public infrastructure. And, you know, local governments that are not complying with these state goals may see reductions in their funding from the state. The second approach is what I've called the regional approach. California in 2008 introduced the Sustainable Communities and Climate Protection Act, otherwise known as SB 375, and this provided that the metropolitan planning organizations, the MPOs, would prepare sustainable community strategies, and the aim was to reduce vehicle miles traveled. It also provides incentives to developers that comply with the Sustainable Community Strategy, expedited review, and in some cases, exemption from environmental regulation on a state level. We also have the integrative approach. Florida is one state that has taken this approach because they have a history of land use regulation at the state level, and they have a system in place that maybe some would debate this, but is working for some local governments, working for certain regions. They've kept that in place up until now. And what they did in 2008 is they enacted legislation that required local governments to incorporate as a goal in each local government's future land use element a goal to reduce sprawl. And so the local governments then have the flexibility to figure out which policies they may put in place, how it affects their zoning code, and so forth. But they're all working towards that goal. A fourth approach taken on the state level is what I've called the single-purpose approach or the standalone approach. These are targeted programs or regulations, and notably Virginia in 2009 adopted what they call the secondary street acceptance requirements, which is a set of regulations that impacts developers, and it says to them, when you have newly constructed streets, they must meet certain street interconnectivity standards and other criteria that essentially speak to pedestrian-friendly streets. That the state is interested in having developers building secondary streets, which essentially are neighborhood streets, that interconnect with the overall grid. And what it does is it says to a developer, you know, don't put a cul-de-sac in this neighborhood because if you want to turn your streets over to the public sector, you're going to have a problem meeting these standards. And so it's trying to encourage the developers to interconnect subdivisions with the existing city or the existing neighborhood. And then on the local level as well, there are many zoning regulations and zoning tools that cities and counties are using to start implementing smart growth. And in the article, I touch on overlay districts, mixed-use zoning districts, and even form-based codes, which can be complete rewrites of existing zoning codes.
Let's talk a little more about the chapter that you've written on smart growth in Powell on Real Property. There's a list of abbreviations that I've noticed, and let me ask you about one of them. What is a UGB?
Well, a UGB is an urban growth boundary, sometimes referred to as an urban service boundary. The metropolitan area where these have been used most widely is Portland, Oregon, and that's been documented in the media as well as in the courts. The purpose of an urban growth boundary is to control expansion of a metropolitan urbanized area and in turn protect forests and farmland and natural resources lying outside the urban growth boundary. So smart growth advocates are not just interested in walkable communities and urban redevelopment, but they're also interested in preserving natural resources, wetlands, forests, farmland. And the interesting thing about urban growth boundaries is it doesn't necessarily gel well with affordable housing policy because because by putting in place, in some senses, an artificial growth boundary, it does tend to drive up housing prices. And so there is a conflict in some sense between smart growth and other progressive urban policies, including trying to provide more affordable housing.
You mentioned that smart growth policies have changed in recent years. Can you talk, though, about the sort of trends that you're seeing in local policies to implement smart growth?
Sure. On the local level, we're seeing a variety of different policies. Certainly, politics has driven that process, and depending on the current economic climate, depending on the makeup of a local commission, you'll see different types of policies. But in terms of smart growth and cities and counties which are pushing forward the smart growth agenda, we're seeing the protection of water supply being an area where cities and counties that have concerns over an existing water supply are using that situation to try and direct growth back into an existing urban area. They've used moratoriums and other administrative processes to place a halt on development outside an existing urban area and also to limit sprawl. We're also seeing green building incentives and mandates. In certain cities, we've seen ordinances passed which require LEED certification, other standards that deal with green building, that mandate public buildings and civic buildings over a certain square footage must be LEED certified. We've also seen incentives put in place which would encourage developers to achieve green building certifications and in return provide expedited review or density bonuses and height bonuses, things of that sort. And then I think the third trend is the furtherance of form-based zoning. And form-based zoning is really an approach to zoning which regulates the urban form and looks at size and shape of a building as opposed to the use of a building. Miami 21 is probably the most well-recognized example of form-based zoning on a citywide scale. And Miami 21, just to give you a little background, Mayor Manny Diaz, probably about 7 or 8 years ago in the city of Miami, got together with some neighborhood activists, some professionals in the fields of architecture and planning, and really created a vision for the city of Miami to try and make Miami a more walkable city to deal with some of the transitions between residential and commercial areas. Mm-hmm. And then over a period of years, tweaked it. You know, it went through public hearings. Different people put their stamp on Miami 21. And then May of 2010, the City Commission made Miami 21 effective and essentially replaced the existing zoning code with a brand new form-based code, which regulates, but to a great extent, it does not change the uses that are permitted in most of the city of Miami, but it drastically changes the form of city blocks, of private lots. It deals with the setbacks that are affecting pieces of property. It also talks about how close the building must be to the sidewalk. And, you know, as opposed to a Euclidean zoning code, which largely was trying to segregate uses and create space in a city, Miami 21 in many ways is trying to bring uses closer together and create a street facade whereby people who are walking down a street have a more interactive relationship with the buildings on that street. So Miami 21 is really a prime example of form-based zoning and the challenges that cities have when trying to implement a brand new zoning code. And I think we're going to see some of that across other cities in the near future, trying to deal with the regulation of uses and buildings from a form perspective rather than the traditional Euclidean zoning.
One of the things you talk about in your new chapter on smart growth in Powell on Real Property is the analysis courts use when smart growth requirements are challenged.
Right. Generally, courts have said so long as a legislative action is fairly debatable and doesn't offend constitutional rights, equal protection, due process, etc., a court will not disturb the decision of a local government to enact a zoning ordinance or any other ordinance affecting the rights of property owners vis-a-vis the general public. Mm-hmm. Local governments are going to take public policy and do what they want with it. And generally, as long as they're doing it in a way that is based on sufficient evidence that they've hired professionals to back up their decisions, they can, for the most part, regulate on a legislative level fairly broadly. Now, let me carve out a caveat from that general statement I just made about courts generally upholding local government decisions. Depending on the type of regulation and who that regulation is affecting, how broadly that regulation is applied, courts will analyze restrictions put in place in different ways. For example, an urban growth boundary or an impact fee that's put in place, the courts have looked at those for several years now, and a body of case law has developed around those types of regulations. Urban growth boundaries have been upheld as legislative determinations. A determination of a boundary line must be grounded in a rational basis and not be arbitrary and capricious in nature. For the most part, as long as a local government is establishing a boundary line with evidence to support that decision, it's going to be very hard for a particular property owner to claim they should be inside the boundary as opposed to outside the boundary, et cetera. With impact fees, there's actually been a specific dual rational nexus test that has developed over time. Now, each state has a little bit of a different take on it, but generally, a rational nexus must exist between the amount of fee charged and the impact caused by the new development. At the same time, the use of funds received from the impact fee charged must be rational in relation to the funds collected. So, as an example, a city couldn't take that money and build a park down by the ocean for the funds gathered from a hilltop community and along those lines. Now, form-based codes are interesting because they're largely untested in the courts. And what we've seen out of certain challengers is that they're looking towards the takings clause or, in some states, specific statutory protection for private property rights. Smart growth regulations that would reach too far may affect a taking of private property. Particularly susceptible are those regulations that deprive a property owner of all their economic use of the property. We've seen that from the Supreme Court. But those regulations that would put a inordinate strain may give rise to a claim under a statutory basis. For example, in Florida, the Burchett-Harris Act, Chapter 70 of Florida Statutes, provides a cause of action which may include just compensation for a property owner when a specific action of a governmental entity has inordinately burdened an existing use of real property or a vested right to a specific use of real property. And so it goes back to that notion of, are the regulations that are under this smart growth prism, are they impacting particular property owners in a way that is unfair or unbalanced? And I think what we'll see is specific property owners who maybe have a more sympathetic case, maybe a nonprofit entity or a group of homeowners as opposed to a developer or a large commercial venture, you know, that may be the case that carries the day.
You know, I didn't realize that some of these things had begun and people had attempted to put some of these things into place so many years ago. But now looking ahead, what do you see as far as smart growth planning is concerned, say, in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I think in the next 5 years, we may see the landscape being fairly quiet. And I think that's because the real estate market in 2007 and 2008, when it, for the most part, came to a halt in many cities across America, and I know down in Miami, we're still dealing with a very depressed real estate market. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to have several years where local governments are focused on keeping taxes down, on reducing spending. Developers are still struggling to find financing for certain projects. There are a lot of people who are laying low right now, and I think the effect on smart growth policies will be that the landscape will be fairly quiet over the next several years. However, I think when the real estate market comes back, that will trigger a subsequent phase of the smart growth movement, and perhaps it's the, you know, whether it's the second phase or the third phase, however it's dubbed in the future, I think what we're going to see is more mandates dealing with energy efficiency that touch on the green building movement and kind of our takeoffs on the green building movement. And so we'll see more requirements in our requests for proposals that public buildings be LEED certified. We're going to see buildings over 50,000 square feet or buildings over 75,000 square feet being mandated to comply with certain levels of energy efficiency. I think we're also going to see additional form-based zoning. And I think most cities, I believe, will not try and take an approach where they rewrite their entire zoning code. I think that process is very costly. It takes a long time. And there's a lot of challenges that come out of property owners. What we've seen in Miami, for example, are challenges based on concepts of procedural due process violations. There are many requirements in state statute that local governments follow a specific process. In Florida and most states, that they adopt ordinances with certain types of public notice. And there are a lot of property owners who are negatively impacted by a complete rewrite of a zoning code who are looking at procedural defects. They're also looking in Florida at the Burt J. Harris Act. And we've had 14 lawsuits filed in the past several months, which all speak to the Burt J. Harris Act, and they're essentially a lawsuit that is attacking the city's new zoning code on the basis that it inordinately burdens their property. So, you know, these types of challenges are really a result of an attempt by a city to overlay a new zoning code on top of a built environment, and that's a very difficult process. Cities that have been able to implement form-based zoning on a small scale, such as in Orlando with Baldwin Park, in other areas across the country where they've taken neighborhoods that are potentially being redeveloped on a large scale by one or two different developers and coming up with a special overlay district or a mixed-use zoning district, something specific for an area that is going through a redevelopment process, those tend to, while they still have controversy and opponents and there's debate on different issues, they tend to be more achievable in a shorter time frame because they're being conducted on a smaller scale.
Sure.
But I think we'll see some form-based zoning done on a project-specific basis or in specific neighborhoods within existing urban environments, but I don't think we're likely to see a mass wave of form-based zoning codes replacing existing zoning codes.
A little bit at a time, then.
Exactly.
I imagine economics is a big factor right now, too.
Yeah, and I think that there's so many local governments that are hurt right now financially. They cannot afford to spend $5 or $6 million to hire professionals and go through 7 or 8 years. The politics and the finances just don't support that. And I think it's going to be a while before a lot of these local governments, and Florida in particular, is susceptible to this because they took such a hit with real estate values. California, Arizona, you know, lots of these states that have high growth rates. Yeah, it's going to be a number of years before they're at a position to take, you know, big steps in the area of smart growth.
An interesting topic and some interesting issues. Steve, thank you very much for your time and laying some of these things out and analyzing them for us, talking about smart growth on this LexisNexis Legal Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Stephen Wernick of Bills & Sumberg in Miami. This has been the LexisNexis Real Estate Law Community Podcast. Visit the real estate law community and all our communities at www.lexisnexis.com/community. The LexisNexis Real Estate Law Community Podcast, copyright 2011 by LexisNexis, a division of Reed Elsevier Incorporated. I'm Steve Burstler. Thank you for listening.